You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth. Hey!
Spanning the globe to bring you the latest developments in medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja.
We love the earth.
It's time for the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville. Now, here's your host, Russ Belville.
Good day, tokers and tokettes and non-toking lovers of liberty. It is Wednesday, November 1st, 2017, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. My God, it's already November. I can't believe it. We're just moving right along in this 2017 and looking forward to the next year, 2018. We could have four or more states voting on reform efforts. We're looking at the possibility of legalization in Michigan, medical in Missouri, Utah, and definitely we'll have at least one state on the ballot. Oklahoma is already on the ballot for medical marijuana. So we will keep you in tune with that. And of course, we'll bring you Marijuana Election Night 2018 when it rolls around. My annual or biennial, depending on how often the elections happen, review and coverage, live coverage of the votes as they happen live from the headquarters of one of the states that's voting on them. I think I'll probably be in Michigan this year. We shall see. It could be Missouri. We don't know. Also, before we get to the show, I did want to make mention offer our sincerest condolences to the people in New York City who've been victimized by this horrendous terror attack, a terrorist taking a rental truck and running it down a bike pathway, killing eight people, injuring many more. Just a terrible thing to have happen. And when these events happen, I think back to the times I've been to New York, and you know, I've been to that area. I've been where that bike path is. When 9/11 happened, I recalled that I was on that tower just 5 years prior, and just a terrible thing. And I'm broken up about it. It's just awful to have to report these kind of things. And let's hope that we can all stay safe out there. All right. Coming up on today's show in the news, President Trump's Opioid Commission, headed by Chris Christie, has released their recommendations for combating the overdose crisis. Guess what? Medical marijuana is not in there. What? Can you believe it? Actually, though, it is in there. It's actually rejected in it. So we'll bring you the details of that in What in the News. Also, we'll have an activist agenda featuring police abuses in the war on drugs from the Reform Conference and a radical rant on the end for my friend Randy Philbrick. But first, let's get to the news.
This is your Cannabis Headline News. Brought to you by MarijuanaMoment.net. The complete source for all your marijuana news in one morning newsletter from Marijuana Majority founder Tom Angel. Subscribe today for free at MarijuanaMoment.net.
This is your Cannabis Headline News for Wednesday, November 1st, 2017. I'm Russ Belville. President Trump's Commission on Addressing the Opioid Overdose Epidemic released its report of recommendations, pointedly rejecting the idea of increasing access to medical marijuana. Recent studies have shown states with legal access to marijuana show markedly lower rates of drug overdoses and pharmaceutical prescribing. Governor Chris Christie, chair of the commission, quote, acknowledges that there is an active movement to promote the use of marijuana as an alternative medication for chronic pain and as a treatment for opioid addiction, end quote. In rejecting the comments of over 8,000 citizens, Christie cited, quote, a two times greater chance that the marijuana user would become an opioid user and abuser, end quote. Christie also compared a lack of data, quote, on dose potency and abuse potential for marijuana, end quote, to the previous two decades, quote, when opioid prescribing multiplied across healthcare settings and led to the current epidemic of abuse, misuse, and addiction, end quote. A Nevada-based tribe is suing the San Joaquin County Board of Supervisors, as well as the county's council and the Drug Enforcement Administration, over the removal of 26 acres of what it's calling industrial hemp. Court papers obtained by KCRA show that the tribe is asking for a temporary restraining order, return of the plants, and a declaration that a San Joaquin County ordinance that targets these kind of grows is unlawful. The Winnemucca tribe rented the property in Stockton to grow what it calls industrial hemp. Industrial hemp is legal to grow under the California Industrial Hemp Farming Act. On October 10th, the DEA and San Joaquin County Sheriff's Office entered the property and seized the plants. While the tribe claims there was only 26 acres, the DEA claims there was substantially more. In its claim, the tribe, while claiming it is simply for research purposes and is not marijuana, touts the health benefits of cannabinoids, the substance used in medicinal marijuana. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has issued warning letters to four companies illegally selling products online derived from marijuana that claim to prevent, diagnose, treat, or cure cancer without evidence to support these outcomes. The Connecticut Post reports that FDA stated that the illegally sold products allegedly contain cannabidiol, a component of the marijuana plant that is not FDA approved in any drug product for any indication. The companies received warning letters, distributed the products with unsubstantiated claims regarding preventing, reversing, or curing cancer, killing, inhibiting cancer cells or tumors, or other similar anti-cancer claims. FDA issued warning letters to four companies, Green Roads Health in Florida, Natural Alchemist in California, and That's Natural Marketing and Consulting, and Stanley Brothers Social Enterprises LLC, both of which are in Colorado. According to a story in the Indianapolis Star, the parents of a 20-month-old girl say Indiana child welfare authorities threatened to take the child away from them because they chose to treat her epilepsy with a legal cannabis extract. The CPS dropped the case after a state legislator intervened and emphasized the legality of the treatment in Indiana. Governor Eric Holcomb's office said CPS acted appropriately, working to ensure the child's safety, but State Senator Mark Mesmer, who intervened on behalf of the child, said CPS overreacted. A new paper at Georgia State University claims that medical marijuana laws, quote, lead to a $2.47 decrease in per person prescribed opioid spending among young adults over a year, end quote. The author, a student at Andrew Young's School of Policy Studies, surmises the substitution of cannabis for opioids leads to the decrease and notes that, quote, states that allow home cultivation experience even larger decreases and that, quote, the decreasing effects are persistent over time and they get stronger following the years of implementation, end quote. A New Jersey appeals court has ordered state regulators to reconsider whether marijuana deserves being categorized as a Schedule I substance lacking medical value in light of its, quote, abundantly and glaringly apparent, end quote, health benefits. The 2-1 ruling handed down Tuesday by a state appellate court requires the New Jersey Division of Consumer Affairs to reconsider the plant's legal standing in light of lawmakers legalizing medical marijuana in 2010. This has been your Cannabis Headline News for Wednesday, November 1st, 2017. I'm Russ Belville.
You're listening to The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
Hi, I'm Russ Belville from The Marijuana Agenda. If you appreciate my full-time dedication to reporting and analyzing the news about cannabis, consider becoming a patron of the show. For just $4.20 per month, you'll help keep my live stream and podcast free while earning yourself your own private ad-free podcast link for the show, as well as links to the supporting articles and data. For a $9.99 VIP subscription, you'll get all that plus my exclusive research, data tables, and graphics. Just log on to mjagenda.com and click the Become a Patron button today.
The Marijuana Agenda, like the gay agenda, only with better music.
Looking for the 420 friendliest way to visit beautiful legal Potland, Oregon?
I'm Lori Duckworth, inviting you to come stay with us at Delta 9 House and Studios.
You get your own private room with queen bed and access to our high-speed Wi-Fi, premium entertainment system, and more.
We'll even cook you breakfast. Look us up on Facebook at Delta 9 House.
That's facebook.com/Delta9House.
Delta 9 House is booked through Airbnb.com, City of Portland, permit number 17-159855.
People should say no to drug use.
It's really, really easy.
Adding more gasoline to the fire.
Lackadaisical.
Really tough, really big, really great to infect and rot our nation.
Dangerous and gateway drugs.
We don't need to be legalizing marijuana.
To build and grow a stronger, healthier, and drug-free society.
All right, welcome to What in the News, our segment where we take a deeper look at one of the stories in our cannabis headline news. And of course, the big story today is the release of the recommendations by the Trump Opioid Overdose Commission. This is chaired by Governor Chris Christie. It's got a number of drug warriors on the panel. Bertha Madras is on that from former ONDCP. You got Patrick Kennedy's involved. He's the head of one of the founders of Project Samuel. I mean, it's just laden with drug war ideology. So you've got to recognize that what we're going to get out of these recommendations are not going to be anywhere near comporting with facts, science, reason, and logic. Much less compassion, because we've been telling the tale show after show, month after month, of all of these studies from various authors, various research institutions coming at this problem from different angles with different data, and they all keep showing the same thing. You give people access to cannabis, there's less problems with opioids. It doesn't matter what you're measuring. Deaths, overdose deaths, 25% fewer if they got access to medical marijuana. Prescription of pills themselves, 1,826 fewer pills per person, painkiller pills. And that's just the painkillers, right? You know, the anti-anxiety, the antidepressants, those go down too. And of course, if you're talking about money, well, then you got Medicare, Medicaid paying for those kind of drugs, and they don't have to pay for all those pills. They could have saved $1 billion. It could have saved, if it was legal in all 50 states, Medicaid could have saved $1 billion, or Medicare, or I think the two of them combined. Regardless, it's a whole bunch of money with commas in it, right? We could save a lot of money here. Doesn't matter how you, the study we just talked, paper we just talked about, $2.47 per person per year reduction in costs if you got a medical marijuana law. They looked at the people who die in car wrecks. They take the blood of people who die in car wrecks. They're finding less opiates in the blood of people in car wrecks in the medical marijuana states. And that's a pretty good random sample of people. Maybe you're getting people that are a little more risky in their driving habits, perhaps, but still you're finding less opiates in their blood. How about rehab admissions? People going checking into rehab for opiates. That's down too. I mean, any way you look at this, access to medical marijuana, access to cannabis, legal access for adults is the key to getting out of this opiate overdose crisis. You've got to give people an alternative. Now, that is even echoed by this commission. This is a quote from Governor Christie's letter. National Institutes of Health Director Dr. Francis Collins has been partnering with pharmaceutical companies, wink, to develop non-addictive painkillers and new treatments for addiction and overdose. The commission worked with Dr. Collins to convene a meeting with industry leadership, wink, to discuss innovative ways to combat the opioid crisis. The commission also held a public meeting to highlight the progress and innovation occurring today resulting from NIH's National Institute of Health's work. This type of scientific progress is a positive step to help free the next generation from the widespread suffering addiction is causing today. Well, folks, you know how we got where we're at now? Because in 1993, Purdue Pharmaceuticals came up with this new formulation of a synthetic opiate that they said, hey, we've got this new non-addictive painkiller. It's a non-addictive pain. You can't get addicted to it. It's perfect for painkilling. It's called OxyContin. How'd that work out? So they want to keep pouring government money into the pharmaceutical company's pockets, who then, of course, return the favor by donating heavily to these senators and representatives and other elected officials at the state level and so forth. The nice little revolving door they got there to try to find yet another synthetic, another alternative we could come up with that would be non-addictive. Well, what about the medical marijuana? We showed you all the studies. We've sent you all the letters and all the comments. What about the medical marijuana? This is what Governor Christie had to say about the non-addictive alternative painkiller known as cannabis. Quote, the commission acknowledges that there is an active movement to promote the use of marijuana as an alternative medication for chronic pain and as a treatment for opioid addiction. Recent research out of the NIH's National Institute on Drug Abuse found that marijuana use led to a 2.5 times greater chance that the marijuana user would become an opioid user and abuser. The commission found this very disturbing. End quote. Okay, so how can I tear this apart? How many different ways? Number one, it's gateway theory thinking. It's that little math where you do, okay, we take a look at people that have gotten addictions to opioids, and then we see, did they use weed? Hell, look back and see if they drank milk or ate Cocoa Puffs at some point in their life, it'd be just as relevant. And the other part that's dumb about this rejection is the people who are suffering from the opiate addictions now have already taken the opiates. Banning marijuana, trying to restrict their access to marijuana, isn't going to affect whether or not they have a 2.5 times greater chance of becoming an opiate addict. They already are. Jeez, let them smoke a joint, Chris. God. Here's the second part of this quote on the marijuana. the marijuana rejection. Quote, there is a lack of sophisticated outcome data on the dose, potency, and abuse potential for marijuana. This mirrors the lack of data in the 1990s and early 2000s when opioid prescribing multiplied across healthcare settings and led to the current epidemic of abuse, misuse, and addiction. The commission urges that the same mistake is not made with the uninformed rush to put another drug legally on the market in the midst of an overdose epidemic. You catch that? He's trying to say that in the 70s and 80s, we had overdoses from heroin and cocaine. And in the midst of that, in the 90s and 2000s, we came out with these OxyContins and Vicodins. And we didn't have a lot of data about how those would work and how those could be abused and how those would cause addictions. And so we wouldn't want to make the same mistake with weed. Yeah, that's what he's saying. He is directly comparing the lack of the long-term addiction potential and health harms of OxyContin in the 90s with us not having any of the same sort of information about marijuana now. I know, I can hear you already. 7,000 years we've been using cannabis. We've had medical marijuana since 96. Yeah, I hear you. I'm with you on that too. How much more evidence do you need? You go to PubMed.gov, you type in cannabis with an asterisk, so you get cannabinoid, cannabis, and so forth. But you type that in the search term for PubMed, you will find over 25,000 studies on cannabis. What more do we need to know? Now, some other things in this report that are quite interesting. We are recommending that a drug court be established in every one of the 93 federal district courts in America. They're pushing for the drug courts. 44% of U.S. counties do not have an adult drug court. We need more drug courts. And then what else is in the letter? Today, only 10.6% of youth and adults who need treatment for substance use disorder receive that treatment. This is unacceptable. Too many people who could be helped are falling through the cracks and losing their lives as a result. Yeah, you know why? Because the beds are full of potheads that a drug court forced to go to rehab. You want to establish more drug courts to put more potheads in rehab beds, and in the same letter complain that not enough people on opiates can get a rehab bed. And one of their most urgent recommendations among more than 50 provided in the final report is calling for an expansive national multimedia campaign to fight this national health emergency. That's right. We're going to have the just say no to drugs campaign, right? This campaign, including aggressive television and social media outreach, oh yeah, well, let's see how well they do on Twitter, this'll be fun, must focus on telling our children of the dangers of these drugs and addiction, and on removing stigma as a barrier to treatment by emphasizing that addiction is not a moral failing, but rather a chronic brain disease with evidence-based treatment options. They should stop being afraid or ashamed of seeking help. Well, part of the fear of seeking help is that these drugs are illegal. Then I just talk about the heroin, the marijuana, or even having illegal prescription drugs. The criminal punishment that's involved is what stops a lot of people from seeking help. And then in the same damn paragraph to say that you're going to have an aggressive television campaign to tell kids the dangers of drugs and addiction, how awful and terrible and devastating it is, but we're not going to have any stigma around it. It's awful and terrible and wicked, and don't you ever do it. But if you do, there's no stigma. It's okay. It's okay to get help. There's no stigma in it at all. And finally, the expectation of eliminating a patient's pain as an indication of successful treatment. This must end immediately. That's too scary for me to even make a joke about.
All we want to do is pump you up.
All right, that sound means it's 20 after the hour. Time for us to take our union-mandated safety briefing. We've been quite unsafe over the past few podcasts. It's time to get safe again. When we come back, Activist Agenda with a great panel, Andrea Ritchie and Major Neil Franklin, among others, talking about police abuses in the war on drugs. And then a radical rant. Randy Philbrick's got it coming.
If you work in the cannabis industry, consume marijuana, or just support freedom, you need to know about breaking policy news that affects you. Marijuana Moment is the daily newsletter that helps you stay on top of all the latest and most important state, federal, and international cannabis developments. Brought to you by longtime legalization activist Tom Angel, Marijuana Moment puts a concise yet comprehensive overview of cannabis news in your inbox early every weekday morning. Wake up to Marijuana Moment and rest assured you'll be ready for the cannabis news that's driving the day. Subscribe now at marijuanamoment.net.
The marijuana agenda, like the alcohol agenda. But a lot safer. After 5 years of legal marijuana in Colorado and Washington, both states have shown no increase in teen use of marijuana and decreases in marijuana DUI arrests, while generating tens of thousands of jobs and hundreds of millions in tax revenue. Legalization is no longer a theory. It's a proven public policy benefit. Tell your elected officials it's time to end adult marijuana prohibition.
Hi, I'm Russ Belville. Join me as I cover the marijuana agenda at the Oregon Marijuana Business Conference the weekend of November 18th and 19th in beautiful Ashland, Oregon. The OMBC is Oregon's biggest and longest-running conference dedicated to the cannabis industry and marijuana activism. You'll hear an extended interview with influential state Senator Floyd Prezansky, a VIP reception and keynote address from the legendary Henry Rollins, and a free after party featuring music from Hieroglyphics and Souls of Mischief. Plus, you'll get information from 40 industry exhibitor booths and be able to question members of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission regarding cannabis issues they'll be ruling on. Visit OregonMBC.com to learn more and book your tickets now. That's OregonMBC.com for the Oregon Marijuana Business Conference. We'll see you there.
Activism begins with ACT. The Marijuana Agenda features the stories of hardworking grassroots activists working for an end to prohibition in today's Activist Agenda.
On today's episode, we go back to the Drug Policy Reform Conference 2017 in Atlanta, Georgia, for this panel on how the drug war justifies police misconduct, featuring Andrea Ritchie, attorney and organizer from New York, Chris Nyrop, the lead national support director, and Neil Franklin, executive director of Law Enforcement Action Partnership.
And we're talking about solutions to bad policing, police abuse in the name of the war on drugs. Can you talk a little bit about how you see policing the war on drugs and particularly the impact on women of color working in, and what solutions you might find to the problems with that?
Certainly. Thank you. So I apologize so much for being late. I was on a solutions panel at Afropunk, so you're seeing me like right after I was the coolest I'll ever be in my entire life. Everything else is like, you know. I am a Black lesbian immigrant. I have been working on issues of police violence against Black women and women of color for the last 20 years and just published a book on it. And the war on drugs is definitely at the center of my work because it's one of the primary sites of mass incarceration and criminalization of Black women. We know the war on drugs to be the driver of the continuing reality that Black women are twice as likely to be incarcerated as white women, even as those racial dynamics are changing through meth and opioid and different patterns of prosecution. I just don't want us to forget that Black women are still being criminalized at twice the rate. And then looking at the police interactions that are driving that. And I think that we think a lot about racial profiling, but don't think about how it takes racially gendered forms, and that there is a profile. We all know kind of maybe about the welfare queen profile of black women, but we think about there's a uniquely racially gendered profile of black women as drug users and as drug concealers, and as maybe low-level drug sellers also, that permeates every interaction with black women by police officers. And so, for instance, just the other day, a black woman was shot by police in Miami Beach. It's a long, complicated situation, but basically, the initial reaction is she must have been on drugs. And then somehow that justified them shooting her in a situation where they could have done something else, right? So she was actually, I think, in the middle of a mental health crisis, but the assumption was that she was on drugs and therefore needed to be stopped by lethal force if necessary. And so that also leads to the kinds of strip searches that we've been hearing about, public cavity searches of black women. Charnesia Corley is a woman who, if you Google her, you'll find a video of her talking about being pulled over at a traffic stop for failing to stop at a stop sign, which how many people have failed to stop at a stop sign? Right? Like, you've never done that because you know better. In that situation, then, you know, the officer claimed to smell marijuana on her, made her wait an hour for a woman officer to show up, who then pulled her pants down, threw her on the ground, pulled her legs open, and for 11 minutes probed her insides. So I say that not to re-traumatize folks or to reproduce kind of the violation of black women's bodies, but to say that is how the war on drugs is waged on black women's bodies, and that is normalized by the war on drugs, and that is presumed by the war on drugs. And I just want to give another example that's maybe equally traumatizing, just to prepare you, of a black woman named Frankie Perkins in Chicago, that these things can be fatal as well. So Frankie Perkins in Chicago, officers saw her kind of in a vacant lot on her way home, assumed that she was engaging in drug activity, and believed, they say, that she had swallowed the drug. So they threw her down and choked her, trying to get her to spit them up, and choked her to death. That's how the war on drugs is waged on the bodies of black women in America, and we just don't, like, we're sort of talk about the mass incarceration part of it sometimes. We talk about women like Kendra Smith or Susan Burton, and we need to talk about that, but we also need to talk about women who maybe don't make it to a jail cell because they're killed or because they experience that kind of sexual violation, and then they find nothing, so they're not mass incarcerated, but there's been a huge impact on them in the meantime. And then the war on drugs is also a real driver of police sexual violence, which is a very systemic issue in the United States. It's a weapon of police brutality. It's the second most frequently reported form of police misconduct, but it's not the second most frequently talked about. And the war on drugs is a primary site, because if you say to someone, you could do 25 years for this, whatever I'm gonna plant on you, or say you have, or that you have, or you could do this for me, it's a fairly common thing. It just happened in New York City last week to an underage teenager, it happens on the regular. So just want to name that. You've heard a lot from Lynn Paltrow and others during this conference about how the war on drugs is waged on the bodies of pregnant people, so I won't reiterate that. I will say, for instance, I don't know if you've heard this as much, that, you know, for trans and gender nonconforming folks who may be using hormone replacement therapy and have syringes on them, there's a presumption that those syringes are about drugs. And there's actually a huge amount of profiling of queer folks as drug users and couriers and carriers too, and that often those charges are the ones that they'll use to criminalize kind of public expressions of gender nonconformity or sexual nonconformity. So I list that parade of horribles to then say, when we're thinking about solutions, we need to go there, right? And so when we're talking about reparations from the drug war, I want reparations for every time a woman had to give someone oral sex, a police officer oral sex, in order to avoid a drug charge or under threat of a drug charge. I want reparations for every woman who's lost a kid because, you know, she had a blunt on her, and, you know, every other white woman who drank excessively and never lost her kid, right? Like, I want reparations for those kinds of manifestations, and I want us to think about police reform in that way, right? I mean, I think we don't do enough around strip searches. I don't think we do enough around cavity searches. I think that legal reform has limitations because, for instance, you can, you know, that public strip search of Charnesia Corley was clearly unconstitutional, But you can strip search people with a warrant, and you can cavity search them with a warrant, as long as it's done in private, right? So there's many stories from airport policing that happened in the 80s up until now of women being taken and forced and strip searched and cavity searched and being forced to experience monitored bowel movements under the assumption that they are carrying drugs in their bodies that are authorized by the courts, right, under a warrant. And so, and we can think about how much perceptions of black women and women of color, again, as concealers of drugs, as consumers of drugs, drive what is considered reasonable and a reason to give a warrant in a situation like that. So, and if we're fighting the war on drugs, then we need to be fighting police sexual violence as part of that, because it's an integral part of how the war on drugs is waged. So those are the solutions, or at least asking if we look at the war on drugs through the lens of women's experience in policing, how that expands the demands that we make, the solutions that we pursue, and how ultimately I think it really pushes us to a demand of decriminalization immediately, because otherwise police continue to have the power to do all the things I just described for black and brown women. Thank you.
Before I turn to the audience, I wanted to ask Chris and Neil to talk a little bit about solutions, and particularly to focus on the problem of corruption that Chris mentioned earlier, which is so connected to the war on drugs, given so much money, and also the issue of what approaches we should take to achieve these changes. You know, should we go local? Should we be protesting? Should we be documenting horrors? Where do we start?
So, I mean, I'll just talk about the Seattle example of this, and I mentioned before about changing practice. So, just sort of real quickly, we were involved in Seattle for over a decade of incredibly contentious debate and litigation over massive racial disparity and drug arrests. So in a city where 8% of the population was African American, north of 60% of those being arrested for drugs, and mostly for drug sales, were black. And so there was just this incredible, you know, there was court cases, there was contention, the police were felt like they were under siege, the prosecutors felt like they were under siege, the community was definitely under siege. And so nobody was happy with that situation. And so in sort of a moment of peak crisis, we sat down and started talking about a way out of that situation. And so it didn't involve changing policy. What it did was try to get the police out of the business of arresting people for using drugs. And so what we did was we started talking about a thing called law enforcement assisted diversion. And the original point of that was, could we make arrests the strategy of absolute last resort for drug offenses, and in particular, sales, right? So, it was an easy thing to say, don't arrest someone for possession. Saying, don't arrest somebody who is actually selling drugs out on a corner is a much harder thing to get police to do. And we were able to do that. And so I know that we're short on time, so I won't go into a lot of detail over that. But what we saw was, and we're seeing it in other places, is that if you can get them to pull back from that practice, and they did it very reluctantly. They were dragged kicking and screaming into this. But what happened was it made their life easier. And in a weird way, if you can make their life easier, it makes them more willing to do it. And so what we have seen is, since launching in 2011, drug arrests basically do not happen in Seattle any longer. I mean, we've gone from, 4,000 felony arrests a year to a few hundred felony arrests. Now, that's a few hundred too many, but there has been a massive plummet in that. And what has changed is officer attitude about why they should do an arrest. And we actually have officers who are saying things like, why would I arrest someone for possession of a crack pipe? And we're like, yes, we're happy that you're saying this. We just want to remind you that there was a time when you were, in fact, actively arresting lots of people for possession of a crack pipe. So could you please go and spread that message of the futility of that approach to other officers? So I'll just leave it with that and let Neil talk.
And that's a good jumping off place for my brief comments here. And let me first say that no law or policy ever justifies police misconduct. It just doesn't. The foundation of the work that we do is constitutional based. It should be. I mean, that's what we take an oath to, right? So that should be the foundation. What we're talking about here is accountability. And policing is, you know, quasi-military, top-down driven. So we're dealing with a leadership issue here. And when it comes to accountability, when it comes to the misconduct of our police officers in the streets, at any level, really where we should first go is to their supervisors, to their mid-level management, and start holding them accountable. I want to give a quick example that you can relate to if you're familiar with the Freddie Gray situation in Baltimore, and that's where I'm from. There was a lieutenant who started the pursuit of Freddie Gray by the bicycle officers. He was part of this three-man unit riding around on bicycles. He called out for them to chase, to pursue Freddie Gray, which they did. They then apprehended Freddie Gray. You know, he didn't respond to that scene where Freddie Gray was initially, you know, which then led to other things. He failed to give the proper instructions once they apprehended Freddie Gray. Still not having probable cause for any type of arrest, but they handcuffed him and it continued. He was responsible for placing Freddie Gray into the transport van. He was responsible for the second stop of pulling him out, shackling him, shackling his feet, placing him back into the van, again, not seatbelted in the van. At every point in that entire scenario, that lieutenant was there and responsible. He should have been the first one held accountable. He should have been the main one held accountable for everything that occurred in that particular instance. So that's one example. As we look at police work in other scenarios, no matter how major, no matter how minor, whether we're talking about, as Harry, as you were talking about, what we call on-view policing, you know, enforcing these drug laws, smelling the marijuana, or say we're smelling the marijuana, and then making the detention and the arrest and the search and everything that comes after that. Again, what are the supervisors doing? Where are the sergeants? How are they guiding? How are they coaching or not coaching or guiding or holding their officers accountable? That's where I think we need to begin with our attention, because then maybe we'll get some good performance or less performance, inappropriate performance from our officers on the street. And I'll wrap up my piece with this. So until we get to the place, and again, I believe that we have to form some sort of policing model where the community really does have oversight of policing, not just when something happens in a review board, but a governance board of the community. They need to be at the beginning controlling the budget. They need to be hiring and firing the chief. They need to be holding mid-level management accountable. And this needs to be done at the community level. Until we get there, there are things that we can do. But it begins with the community rising up, organizing, rising up, you know, putting out good information to the citizens on how to record, how to do it appropriately, how to not get yourself into trouble in doing so, how to talk to and interact with the police when you're doing so, how to report complaints, how to use the tools that are out there. One, for instance, that the ACLU has in recording and filing complaints. We need to do a better job of not just ensuring that our police officers are trained and educated, but ensuring that our citizens are educated in how to do this and how to organize and then place pressure upon our elected officials and police chiefs and sheriffs to demand accountability and to not rest or sleep until we start to see it.
This episode was produced as part of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville, the daily news and interview podcast covering the world of medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. MJAgenda.com.
New beginner guitars and banjos are often constructed much better than ones built before your time. Why struggle? Get a new instrument or fix the old one. The trusted professionals at the Fingerboard Extension will evaluate your instrument for free. Repairs are priced for people who work for a living. Stop by the Fingerboard Extension downtown Corvallis at 120 Northwest 2nd Street today, or check out its inventory on the web at fingerboardextension.com.
You're not high. You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
I was told by the DART Task Force in Toledo that they're actually sprinkling fentanyl on marijuana now.
Okay, maybe you're a little high.
Despite what you may have heard, CBD is not, quote, legal in all 50 states, end quote. The DEA is quite clear that cannabidiol is a Schedule 1 controlled substance banned in all 50 states. Think about it. Why would 17 states pass laws legalizing CBD, and why would there be three bills in Congress to legalize CBD federally if CBD were already legal in all 50 states?
Hey everybody, it's Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda, inviting you to be like me and get your ink done at Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo, Fort Worth's most female-friendly, clean, sterile, awesome tattoo shop. Thomas and his crew are true artists who can design you a custom piece or use a design you bring in. Lucky Horseshoe also offers all styles of tattooing as well as piercings and all-around fun. In the DFW area, stop by Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo and tell them Radical Russ sent you. Trust me, it'll feel awesome.
Total war against public enemy public number one.
10 federal criminal penalties for up to 1 ounce of marijuana.
Marijuana is probably the most dangerous drug.
Legalization is just another word for surrender.
I experimented with marijuana and didn't inhale.
This is not medicine. This is a Cheech and Chong show.
Encourage people to use less drugs.
I am healed. That was the point.
I think we'd be a mistake to leave the state.
Negative reports coming out of Colorado.
Don't smoke marijuana.
So yesterday we went over the story that came out of the Phoenix New Times where the Arizona prohibitionists down there are all upset about the weed maps billboards. And these have been in Michigan and in Massachusetts, all up and down the West Coast, Colorado, and apparently in Arizona as well. They're black billboards, white letters that just deliver some facts about legalization. Like states that have legalized marijuana have experienced 25% reduction in opioid-related deaths. Like there's been no increase in youth marijuana use in the state of Colorado or in Washington. And so the Arizona prohibitionists are all upset about this because it's not true. It's false, deceptive advertising, and they're making a big huff about it. Well, to follow up on that, we've got our own little Oregon prohibitionist here. He's the disgraced former head of Project Samuel here in Oregon, Randy Philbrick. You may remember the story of this guy. He was, you know, Project Samuel, that's Kevin Sabet's anti-marijuana legalization organization. And the head of the state chapter out here in Oregon was Randy Philbrick, until he compared the massacre at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando to the health effects of marijuana legalization. Yeah, it was too far for even Kevin Sabet to accept, so he got booted. Anyway, Randy popped up in my Twitter feed because of one of these billboards out there. It's the one that says, states which legalized marijuana experience up to a 12% reduction in theft. And so he made a little meme of this little picture where he posted side by side some screen clippings from the Oregon State Police reports. And now the left-hand side says in 2015, the total number of larcenies, and that's pickpocketing, purse snatching, shoplifting, car thefts, like snatch and grab from a car, right? Stealing car parts or accessories, bicycles, stealing from a public building, from a coin-op machine, and all other larceny totaled 20,101 offenses in 2015. But then in 2016, it went up to 39,671. Now, I could quibble that the data he's citing there is from Oregon, and the Weed Maps billboards are referencing Washington and Colorado data. But as a professional writer, I kind of have to critique Weed Maps on this one. States which legalized should have read states that legalized, and experience should have been experienced to agree with the verb tense. The way they phrase it, states which legalized marijuana experience up to a 12%. That's future looking. That's a future tense there. That's saying if your state does this, it'll happen for you too. If they had said states which legalized marijuana experienced past tense, it's a little easier to defend. So I gotta be upfront and intellectually honest about that. The way it's worded is a little troublesome. It implies, if you look at it the right way, it implies that this would happen in Oregon too. And he's asserting that here's the numbers showing it didn't. In fact, it went up. I'm such a word nerd, aren't I? Anyway, I thought that data was a little suspicious on first look. A doubling of larceny in a year? 20,000 to almost 40,000? I mean, that's the kind of jump you'd hear about on the news, right? Even outside of drug policy work, right? So, you know me, I look shit up. First, I found Randy's 2016 number, the 39,671. That's in the Oregon State Police's 2016 report, Section 3, Statewide Crimes Against Property, as registered in the ONIBRS. ONIBRS. Onibers, I guess. Then I found Randy's 20,101 number from 2015. It's found in the Oregon State Police's 2015 report, Section 3, Statewide Crimes Against Property, as registered in the OUCR. OUCR. Got that? Randy used 2016 Onibers numbers to compare to 2015 OUCR numbers. I know, I'm such a stats nerd, right? Okay, I'll fill you in. Onibers is the Oregon National Incident-Based Reporting System. OUCR is the Oregon Uniform Crime Reporting. It's a different type of database. The OUCR is a little more summary data, and the Onibers is more incident-level data, more like nitpicky, okay? So, as the 2016 Oregon State Police report explains, quote, data from OUCR and Onibers are not a one-to-one comparison because of the different nature in their methodologies. Agencies submitting data utilizing the incident-based formats, Onibers, are providing a more comprehensive depiction than the data captured by our OUCR categories, end quote. So, he took the summary data that's less data for the 2015 comparison, and then took the detailed data for 2016 that's the much greater number to make it look like it almost doubled. So, what happens if you actually do a one-to-one comparison of apples to apples or oranges to oranges? Well, let's start with the apples, the OUCR data. 2015, there were, as he pointed out, 20,101 larcenies. In 2016, there were 8,520. That's weird. And then you break this down by pickpocketing, purse snatching, shoplifting, etc. It's lower in every category. And if you include burglaries and motor vehicle thefts, car thefts, right? Those were lower too. Seems like in 2016, after we legalized, there was fewer thefts. At least according to these OUCR numbers, right? Maybe it's a fluke. Let's look back. Let's look back to 2014 when marijuana was completely illegal. Because 2015, it became legal to possess in July. It became legal to sell in October. So 2015 is a little mix of somewhat legal, somewhat not legal, right? So how about 2014 when marijuana was still illegal? Well, looky there. It looks like when we voted on legalization in 2014, to the latest data in 2016, a year and a half into it, we've gone from roughly 10 to 2,000 burglaries. We went from about 52 to 8,500 larcenies. And we went from 6.5 to below 1,000 car thefts in that 2-year span. You know. Now, look, to be fair, we did the apples to apples comparison. We should do the oranges to oranges comparison. The more detailed Onabers data, right? Let's do those side by side. 2015, 2016. All right. 2015, there were 38,243 larcenies. 2016, 39,671. Yeah, it went up. It went up 3.7%. Larcenies went up 3.7% the year after legalization fully took effect. Oh, no. But then let's look at that in context. If you take a look at the Oregon State Police reports on larceny going back to 1995, because I'm a stats nerd and I'll do that kind of stuff in an early morning. If you look back, you find that the 3.7% increase, year-to-year increase in larceny in the state of Oregon for the past 20 years is only the fifth largest increase. It's only the fifth. And I had to cut 1 year out because it looks like in 2013, they changed their methodology because there was this massive, massive drop. And there's like, statistically, I can't believe that larceny dropped that much. So there must be a methodology change. So I'm not even including one of them. But the biggest increase happened between 2013 and 2014, increased over 25%. So if legalization in this year is what made larceny go up 3.7%, those other years, 97, 2001, 2012, and 2014, what was the reason that it went up more than 3.7? Interesting. And the other interesting thing is to look at the decreases, which range in the year-to-year decrease in the total number of larcenies. Larceny dropped 8.8% the year after we passed medical marijuana. After we passed Senate Bill 1085 that increased our possession limit from 3 ounces to 24 ounces, increased our plants from, 7 total, something like that, to 6 mature, 18 immature. When we did that massive increase in how much medical cannabis could be grown, it dropped 12.8% larceny drop. Now, look, I want to make one thing perfectly clear. I'm doing all this back and forth with Randy on the larceny statistics just because it's fun to catch him committing an own goal. He totally just whiffed it on this one, trying to meme up on me with some statistics. So that was just fun to do. But let's get to the bottom line on this. It has nothing to do with each other. Whether or not marijuana is legal is not going to determine whether or not someone breaks into a car, whether or not someone pickpockets someone, whether or not someone is shoplifting. What do they think marijuana does to us? I know. Let's go steal stuff from the store. Man, come on, give me a break. This is insane. And a 3.7% increase in a year-to-year, that's, keep in mind, this is overall larcenies, right? This is not a per capita number. The population of Oregon has increased. Now, I'm not saying it's increased 3.7%, but it has gone up. There's all sorts of reasons behind this. And it's just the kind of cherry picking of statistics. So desperate these prohibitionists are to try to find something, anything. There's got to, something bad had to have happened. We're letting adults smoke pot in their houses with the curtains drawn and nothing bad has happened yet. How can this be? It's driving them crazy. And I'll tell you what, folks, it's fun to watch, isn't it? We'll keep watching it. But that's about all the time we got for today. Thanks for tuning in. Join us tomorrow on the show. We're going to have our pal David Rines will be here live in studio. He's moved out of the Pacific Northwest. He's in Las Vegas, Nevada. So we'll have all sorts of things to talk about. See you tomorrow. Till next time, take care of each other, tokers.
Follow MJ Agenda on Facebook, Pinterest, Instagram, YouTube, and follow MJ Agenda Show on Twitter. Learn more at MJAgenda.com.
You take a seat, you plant it, you grow it, you try it, you roll it, you smoke it. You take a seat, you plant it, you grow it, you try it, you roll it, you smoke it. You take a seat, you plant it.